From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 2009, three Americans unknowingly crossed over the border from Iraq to Iran and were detained, an ordeal that lasted more than 2 years. Early on in their captivity, as they were being shuttled from place to place, they wondered not just where they were going, but why they were being held. In a new book the three have written, Shane Bauer describes how, at one point, one of their drivers held out his palm and said, "Obama." Then he blew across it, as if scattering dandelion seeds. And that was the explanation. Bauer says their incarceration wasn't personal, it wasn't legal. It was about geopolitics and the political dynamics between one government and another one. Today in the program, Shane Bauer is joining us, along with Sarah Shord and Joshua Fatal. Their book is called A Sliver of Light. After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the summer of 2009, Shane Bauer, Sarah Shord, and Joshua Fatal were in the Kurdish highlands of Iraq, and they were hiking, just hiking. They knew they were fairly close to the border of Iran, but they had no idea just how close. They weren't far from the ridge of a trail they were walking on when a soldier waved them over the border. And that was the beginning of a nearly two-year, more than two-year ordeal. They were detained. They were eventually imprisoned in Tehran. They were subjected to intimidation and solitary confinement and to intense sessions of interrogation. But they also encountered moments of kindness and moments that raised larger questions about themselves and about the role of their own American government in the world, in the Middle East. They've written a book about the experience of being imprisoned in Iran. It's called A Sliver of Light. Today in the program, they're all three joining us to talk about it. We invite you to join us as well. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joshua Fatal is living in New York City studying history at Columbia College, and Shane Bauer is an investigative journalist and a photographer. Sarah Shord is a writer and educator, contributing editor to Solitary Watch. That's an initiative to raise awareness about solitary confinement. And we should also say Sarah and Shane are married, now living in Oakland. And Joshua, Shane, Sarah, welcome to you all. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So I want to start with, there's something, Sarah, I want to start with you. Because you mentioned something in the book where you were asked by, this was after you had been released and you were working hard to get Josh and Shane released. And you're working with Sean Penn, the actor. It's an interesting sort of section here. And he asked you at some point in this conversation you were having and in the process where he's helping you, he asked you what happened right after you were captured. And it's interesting because you write in the book that you didn't really at those times anyway want to talk about those days. You write this. You said, "It feels like a long time ago, and the present moment is more urgent." Now, I expect you were talking about that you wanted to settle things with Josh and Shane at that time too, but I wondered if you don't, at least there was a time when you didn't want to talk about all of this, if there were times when you wondered if you even did want to write a book. And I want to get a sense of how you're all feeling about going back to those moments now. Sarah, start with you.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that a lot of people, after they experience something really traumatic, really painful, the last thing you want to ever do is look back. And I can completely understand that impulse. For us, it was important to tell the story that we lived. There have been so much speculation about our story. The first year, people had absolutely no information from us, hardly a word. Yeah. And so people made up their own story. And in many ways, that didn't feel to me like my story. And writing it was a very empowering experience, sort of setting the record straight. And it also was a way to kind of guide me through looking at the unresolved parts of my experience and asking myself, what did I get out of this? What ultimately do I have to offer?
Right.
to the world from my experience. And I think that was really beneficial.
Shane, what about you?
You know, this wasn't an easy book to write in a lot of ways. There were times that I just wanted to stop and move on. But I think the reason that it was important for me to write this book was that I felt like, you know, our experience was in some ways a universal experience. There's many people that have been imprisoned wrongfully around the world. And, you know, I think our story is in some ways a story of survival and hope. But we were also, it's also a story that shows that not everybody gets that. You know, not everybody gets out. Not everybody has a happy ending like we did. And, you know, we were fortunate. And in some ways, we were lucky. And I thought it was important to kind of bring that experience to light.
You know, Josh, you've talked about this, actually. It was interesting. You, in an interview I saw, you talked about, you said that if I were an American, I wonder if I really would have cared all that much for the plight of these three Americans who are off and had been imprisoned in Iran. Because you mentioned there are tens of thousands of people who get imprisoned all the time. Why should we key on these three Americans?
That, I mean, that's what I wondered. In prison, I realized that. I realized that I needed people to care for me.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if I would have been that person. And when that hit me, it really hit me. I don't know. I really struggled with who I was and my priorities when that hit me in solitary confinement. And really, that became then central to how I felt like I needed to transform in prison. Hmm. And it became central to what the book became about for me, was that my story, if people were to care, can then be a window into this broader story. And if people can relate to us, if they can relate to our story, then perhaps they can relate to other people.
Hmm. Shane, you write in the book that you guys had a choice where you were going to go. You wanted to go somewhere. It was either you had, I guess, narrowed it down to Lebanon or Iraqi Kurdistan. And as you say in the mm-hmm. book, Sarah had the week off. You guys were living in Damascus. Mm-hmm. You wanted to take a trip. What was the sort of clincher? What made you decide you wanted to go to Kurdistan?
Well, I'd been living in the Middle East for several years at that point, and Sarah and I had been living in Damascus for a year. And we had Josh had come to visit us. Another friend, Sean McFessel, was also visiting us. And we wanted to, you know, kind of show them around, but we also wanted to go somewhere new. I had worked in Baghdad as a journalist, and I had always wanted to go to Iraqi Kurdistan just as a visit because I knew that it was a safe place. I'd read about it in the New York Times, in the Atlantic, as a tourist destination. Mm-hmm. And, you know, no American had ever been injured there. We knew people that had gone there on visits and kind of visited castles and things like that. And, you know, and Josh also had some personal connection to the region. His father was born in Iraq, and it was the only part of Iraq that you could actually go as a tourist. And there was a tourist industry. There's now actually a couple million people a year that go to Iraqi Kurdistan.
The contrast is interesting. I mean, this is one thing that you mentioned. For example, if you were to go to Baghdad, there's this constant fear of bombings and shootings. But in Kurdistan, mm-hmm. fireworks and music and right. dancing.
Yeah. When we were there, actually, it was really a beautiful coincidence. We got there on an election day. There were parliamentary elections, and coincidentally, I had witnessed this parliamentary elections in Baghdad earlier in the year, and the streets were dead. It was like a ghost town. You know, you couldn't drive. Everybody was forbidden from driving. It was too dangerous. And in Kurdistan, it was the opposite. I mean, there were fireworks, there was celebration. It was really a beautiful thing to see.
And I think that's one of the main reasons that our guards were so down. Mm-hmm. I mean, even at the tourist site, that Ahmedawa, where we went hiking behind the waterfall, there were hundreds of people enjoying themselves. Kurdish families go there just to celebrate, you know, being together in life, and that's what the three of us were doing.
We in fact met somebody in prison. Someone we were able to, Shane and I were able to sneak a discussion with, And we found out that he was with Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And it was a sort of a surprising revelation. And we were talking to him while he was in the bathroom, and we were in a small cell next to him. And he's from the mountains of Kurdistan. And he was shocked that that we were still in there, and felt horrible for us. Wow. And felt said, I really wish you guys get free. And here we are talking to an Al-Qaeda guy. Universes apart from each other, but oddly standing on common ground.
See, but that's the sense I get that's what this book is about, that sense of contrast, the ironies of these different kinds of conversations. It's more about, I mean, you hear it talked about as this, you telling the story of your ordeal, but it seems, that seems like a passive kind of way of explaining what this book is about. It's more about relationships, it's more about the ironies, it's more about those kinds of contrasts, at least it seemed to me.
I think that we had a feeling in prison and in writing the book that there is no, we obviously, our situation was terrible, and we wanted to get out as soon as possible.
Sure.
And we were very angry and depressed and many other things. But there was also no kind of clear good guys and bad guys. We were stuck in the middle of a situation, a political situation between the U.S. and Iran. Where there was no clear good side or bad side. There was Iran holding us. There was the U.S. with an aggressive foreign policy in many ways towards Iran, and that fed into the animosity. There were people like members of Al-Qaeda that we met that we bonded with as prisoners, even though we might not have in other ways. And, we connected with interrogators sometimes that we also despised. And, it's just how the world is.
This was something that Shane, you had written about in those early moments, and I wanted to get your sense from all of you. In those early moments, you said when you had been detained, you didn't know what was going to happen. You even wondered whether you might be killed. Mm-hmm. You write this in the book. You said that the immediate prospect of death seems so different than I had imagined it. Explain.
Right. I'm sure that there's listeners that have been there that have, for some reason or another, thought that they might die. And it's just when we're faced with death, there was a moment where a couple days after we were arrested, we were driven through the countryside, and driver or the passenger in the car pulled out a gun, and we're driving into the darkness, and thought that this was it. We were being driven out, we're going to be shot, killed. And what I felt is not what I would have imagined, it would feel like to die. I just felt my life kind of slipping out of me before it happened. And I just, thought, I think of mice, when they're killed or held by a cat and they're not actually dead, but they kind of go limp. That's what it felt like. It was like preparing to die. And it wasn't a kind of defiant moment,
Yeah.
Yeah. And also what you were saying, reminds me that I went to the Middle East. I moved to the Middle East because I wanted to complicate my experience of the Middle East. Mm-hmm. I was really involved in politics. And of course, I wanted to be a part of, in a very, very small way, undoing a lot of the damage that the U.S. wars have done in the region by teaching Iraqi refugees and helping them pursue higher education. But ironically, that also happened in Iranian prison. It complicated Iran for all of us in ways that were unexpected. When I was first imprisoned, I assumed and feared that all of the women around me hated me and assumed that I was a spy and believed what their government was saying about us. And I found the opposite to be true. The women, Iranians know their government better than anyone, and we were in a political prison.
Yeah.
We were in a place where everyone there is in opposition to their government, and it was one of the heights of opposition in recent history in Iran. And we had people tell us that, women used to shout down the hall, "I love you, Sarah." If I was in the clinic, women would break past the guards and throw their arms around me. We passed notes. It's the same thing that I experienced and many Americans that travel in the Middle East experience all over the Middle East, which is that people make a distinction between their government,
right,
but between, one's government and one's own identity. So just as I was surprised in Syria and Yemen and Lebanon that people didn't hate me because I was American, I was likewise surprised in Iranian prison.
There were so many Irans, and in some ways that's what we hope to depict. is, well, you know, Shane writes about being, thinking he's going to die. We read about hearing Death to America chanted outside our cell the morning we were about to go to court for the first time. We also read about these moments of connection, these moments where a prisoner down the hall tells me he's praying for me to get out. Another a guard is telling me that he hopes I get free. The way our prisoners snuck candies to us in the bathroom. And so it's only contradictory if we think about Iran so simplistically, but really there are many different Irans.
Sarah, I wanted to ask you, you write about being raised by a single mother after some domestic disputes with your father, you traveling with her from Chicago to Los Angeles. And you mention on that trip that, you put it this way, my world exploded on that trip. Seemed to have kind of opened your eyes about, I don't know, about something, about the world maybe? What was it?
Well, I mean, I'd never left Chicago. Yeah. I'd hardly left Oak Park, which is a suburb of Chicago. We didn't have any money when I was growing up. My mom, she worked as a waitress at night, and she was in nursing school during the day. And after she left my father, we didn't even have money to rent a car. We did one of those things where someone pays you to drive their car across the country.
Yeah.
And I was completely dumbfounded by the beauty of our country. It just seemed to go on forever and ever. And I've thought many times, what was it that started my passion for travel? And my mom has always had that passion. I mean, she hasn't always had the means to travel, or she's always had to work and, you know, take care of me and my brother and sister. But she always encouraged me to follow my passion, follow my dreams.
You say that she never knew whether to discourage your sense of wildness or not. And what she ultimately wanted was for you to trust yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And I went back to that so many times in prison. I always felt my mother with me. It's amazing, actually, when you've lost everything and really have no idea when or even if you'll get it back, how much. The only thing that you really own, the only thing that you are your memories and your relationships with people that bring meaning to your existence and really can't be taken away.
Shane Bauer, when did you first get a sense of, you know, a larger sense of the world? Was it through travel? Was it something that was sort of you'd always wanted to learn about the world? I mean, what set you off on, you know, on a sense of wonder about the world?
That's a good question. You know, I think similarly, my mom kind of instilled in me a curiosity, and I grew up in a small town in rural Minnesota, moved to California, and I was a welder at that time and worked in a shop, and I decided to save up money, and I traveled. I was 19 and traveled to Europe, and I was on that trip during September 11th, 2001, and I had met someone who had been in the Middle East, and I was kind of shocked that, you know, he would go to the Middle East. This was actually before September 11th, and he told me about it and told me, you know, how he had such a great time, and I decided to go there, and I loved the region. I decided to learn the language. There was already kind of talk at that time by 2002 of invading Iraq, and I realized that this was going to be an important region to kind of understand and to be involved in, and, you know, kind of from there decided to become a journalist and had basically traveled back and forth ever since then.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. There's the story you tell. This was when you were in the prison in Tehran, and one of the guards, whom you describe as the slimy weasel, among other things. I'll clean that up. But he's pacing around, and he asks you what your first experience was with politics was, your first memory of that. Uh-huh. And you mentioned how you when you grew up, you weren't far from the Ojibwe reservation. And tell that story, if you would, because I thought that was interesting.
Well, that was such an interesting interaction, an interesting interrogation, actually. He would kind of sometimes be friendly with me and tried to get me to kind of chat with him. And I was never sure whether I should or not, but I also wanted him to like me because maybe if he liked me, he would feel bad and then maybe he would try to get us out. And so I told him my honest answer, and I was in elementary school and in Minnesota, in Onamia, Minnesota, and a bunch of kids got up and start walking out of the classroom all across the school. And I didn't know why at first, and I found out that they were walking out because they didn't want the Native American kids to go to that school. They were demanding that they go to school on the reservation. And it was really this formative moment for me because a lot of people that I thought were friends were walking out, and I couldn't believe it. And they every day came back to school and picketed outside the school, demanding that the Native American kids go to school on the reservation. And at the end of the week, the school actually brought some buses in, and all of the Indian kids got on the buses, and they drove them to the reservation. And that was just the first time that I really understood racism in this country and how extreme it was. It was a really formative experience.
Do you feel conflicted now about revealing? Because there are all moments, and this happens to all of you, it seems, these moments where you're wondering, should I reveal my real sentiments about my life, my real, you know, the beginnings of my sort of political sensibilities and personal sensibilities? Should I reveal myself to these people? And there were moments when it seems like you regret it, moments when you feel like maybe it was okay to do it. Talk right. about your kind of conflicted feelings about all of that. I wanted to hear from all of you on that.
Yeah, my feelings were very conflicted. With my interrogator, they sort of set it up from the beginning where there was the good guy and the bad guy, and the one who tried to be intimidating, the other one who tried to play this role of sort of savior. And I actually quite revealingly started calling him Father Guy, yeah. and it made me realize that somehow psychologically he had wormed his way into one of my deepest issues, which was growing up without a father. And when you're helpless like that, really the deepest, most unresolved parts of you are the most vulnerable. They come to the surface. And I put a lot of trust in my interrogator. He said that he knew we were innocent. He was very kind. He gave me books. We loved some of the same books. He was a Virginia Woolf fan. Mm-hmm. And we recited poetry together. And I started to believe he was my friend. And then he came in one day and he said, "Sarah, I've led you to believe that you're going to court. And then when you go to court, you'll go home. But I can't say that anymore." He said, "I don't know if when you'll go to court. And if you do, I don't think it will be good." And he said, "I'm leaving and you may never see me again." And I really, that was one of the lowest moments for me, that when the true realization that we could be there for years or could never get out hit me. And I went into the deepest depression and I swore to myself I would never trust anyone in that context. Anyone that works for a political prison right. is not deserving of my trust.
Shane, what about you?
You know, my name for my interrogator in my mind was Weasel, and I hated this man. You know, I hated the power he had over me, just the way that he dealt with me, and he would always tell me, "I'm your friend." And when he would tell me that, you know, I knew he was trying to manipulate me. But at the same time, when I was sitting in my cell in solitary confinement, every day I hoped that he would come. I hoped that he would come so I could talk to him, so I could have somebody to talk to. And no matter how much I despised them, I needed them. We needed our interrogators, and they were our window to the outside world. And that was a really difficult relationship to have and to manage, you know. I just felt so vulnerable in that situation that I never knew what worked, you know. I tended towards kind of trying to maintain strict boundaries with them most of the time and not let them in any way. And, you know, that was my strategy. Sarah's strategy at the time was kind of to try to befriend her interrogator, you know, and, you know, we all kind of, and we were doing all this in isolation,
right.
But we all kind of developed our own strategies for both trying to do what we thought would help get us out and to do what we needed to do to survive and have some kind of human connection in such isolation.
Josh, tell a little bit about your interrogator.
Yeah. My interrogator was pretty stone cold with me.
Yeah.
And he just wanted the facts, and he didn't want to chat. And at first, during my interrogations, initially when we arrived, when we found ourselves in Iran, I didn't want people to know. I thought I should hide the fact that I'm Jewish and that my father's Israeli. I thought that wouldn't be helpful to our cause of getting, you know, of going right back and going back to Iraq and being released immediately. But after a few weeks, they knew. They could. They got into my email and found out, and they knew I was Jewish. But I didn't want to tell them of all my, you know, different trips. Half my family lives in Israel, and they said, "Well, they want to know when you go to Israel and what did you do there?" And I was just so nervous because it was like, because I know there's so much tension between those two countries that if how could this be, you know, construed into a way that I was a spy? And my father, in fact, was born in Iraq before he moved to Israel and then America, which is where I was born. And I can see their mind weaving stories of me having family connections with these, and then having family with the Israeli government and the American CIA. And none of this is true. But I just was so scared, so I didn't want to tell him. And that really got my mind going in circles, especially during solitary confinement and during an interrogation. And at some point, I kind of let it go. I don't know how it happened, but I realized that it would be more worth it for me to just be myself and be my full as the thing is in prison, the layers and layers of yourself get shed, and you can only be down to pretty much a body, a warehoused body. But there's still all these other layers. There's these layers of friendship and relationships and a son, a brother, a friend, all these different ways of being a friend, and all those get stripped apart away. And being Jewish, being secular, being all these different parts of me. And what happened to me is I just felt like I needed to reclaim that piece of me that I was so scared of, which was my Jewish heritage and my father being Israeli. So I decided, okay, you know, you can know, but and you know, at that point, you know, if that's a crime to you, then that's a crime. But I can't hide who I am, and at least that it made it easier for me to relate because I didn't feel like I was hiding something because you know I was innocent. There was nothing to hide.
Yeah.
And then the guards sort of started to change, started to become simultaneously curious as well as suspicious.
Right.
But the curiosity kind of struck me because, and with the curiosity, there was a reaching out too. There were guards that would come up to me, and some of them would say, you know, Jew, no problem, no problem. I'd be relieved for a moment, and I'd say, Israel problem.
Yeah.
And so there was an important differentiation they were making. Also, other guards would come and look at me and say you Jewish, Moses, and then point to my secular friends and say Jesus, and point to themselves and say Muhammad, one God, you know, point and then point up and say one God. For whatever that meant, it meant that they were reaching out to not see us as separate antagonistic entities based on religion, and that was a welcome impulse.
Mm. Joshua Fatal is with us, Sarah Short also with us, Shane Bauer. Together they've written a new book. It's called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the three Americans who were captured by Iranian forces while hiking near the border in 2009. They had crossed over from Iraq without knowing it, thrown into prison in Tehran for months and months, where they were charged with espionage, subjected to solitary confinement, to harsh interrogation. They've written a new book about all of this. It's called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. Joshua Fatal, Shane Bauer, Sarah Shord. They're joining us from the studios of NPR in New York City. I wanted to ask, Sarah, there is a story that you tell in the book. No guard had really come inside your cell before. This was early on. One day, a young female guard comes in, right at the time, really, when you talk about that you had kind of broken down, first time in weeks, and she was there. And there's this kind of touching moment, this expression of love that you come to question a little bit later, but it seems to sort of define that sense of feeling vulnerable and not sure what the motives are of these people. I wanted you to tell that story, if you would.
Yeah. Well, in those early weeks, really that first month, I had absolutely no context for anything that was happening to us. Mm. I didn't know what a prison guard was like. The closest I'd come to prison guards were through novels and movies. And with her name was Rasavi, and she was beautiful. Just physically, she had a beautiful voice. She was so warm. And it was, I mean, in those early weeks of solitary confinement, it was just an incredible balm, a soothing source of kindness. And her kindness to me, I accepted just innocently, openly. And then weeks later, we heard the most horrifying sound to this day I've ever heard, a man just screaming, the most animal noises. We'll never know what was being done to that man, but it sounded like he was being brutally tortured. And I rang the small bell that I had, and Rasavi came, and I was so happy that it was her. And I asked her, I would pantomime, right? At that point, knew two words of Farsi. And I kept pointing in the direction the scream was coming from and putting my hands around my neck, like strangling myself. And she said, no, no, no. And she smiled like it was really hilarious, this whole performance I was putting on. And she came back a few minutes later, and she said, football. She was trying to calm me by telling me that this man was playing football. And that in my whole... That was a profound reckoning for me for what a prison guard is. No matter how kind of people they are, they live in a place where people are being brutalized. And they've come to terms with that on a certain level. And I just couldn't believe that this young woman was fine with it. Mm.
Shane, you tell about one of these early interrogations where you mentioned that the interrogator who's interrogating you mentions that... he had heard that you and Sarah had attended these anti-war protests together. Mm. And he says, if that's true, that in fact you did protest against your government, then mm-hmm. that's a good thing. We want you to be free then. And he said, right. You are a human being like me. I'm going to go have dinner with my family, and you deserve to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Now, do you get a sense that was real empathy, or was, you know, did you all, again, figure you're just being played?
Mm. Well, that was a... translator that said that to me, mm-hmm. and you know, he might have meant it. I never saw him again after that. I don't know why, but he, you know, I felt pretty quickly that our identities, our beliefs, nothing, none of that mattered. You know, I would in my interrogations try to tell my interrogators, you know, look at my journalism. I had, you know, done exposés on corruption yeah. in Iraq, U.S. military corruption, and the kind of supporting and training of a special forces group that was kind of acting as a death squad. And, you know, I thought maybe if they see this, they'll see that I'm not just some kind of person that is out to attack Iran, and I am also kind of critical of my own government. And that didn't matter. I mean, they could easily kind of pull those things into their spy narrative. They would just, anything that contradicted their narrative, they just said was a good CIA cover, you know, that anything that we did, whether it was like, you know, journalism or attending an anti-war rally, was just in preparation for that moment, you know, that we were coming to spy on Iran.
Josh, you had conversations with one of the friend who wants to try to connect with you, asks you about 9/11, and you mentioned your conversation with him, at least at this particular moment you write about, I think was really interesting. And you tell him that we're trapped in this cycle of violence. You say to him that you understand how your detention is blowback after decades of hostilities and policies between these two governments. And then you mention that you don't want to be too solicitous. But you say this, you said, but you did want him to know that if you had been an Iranian 30 years ago, that you would have been there in the streets with the revolution. Talk about that conversation, but none of that justifies what had happened, you say. But talk about that moment. I think that was interesting.
Well, just to clarify, in 1979, when the Iranian Revolution took place, no one knew exactly what form it would take. What they were protesting was, a corrupt monarch, a king,
the Shah,
that was taking a bunch of money from foreign powers and giving away their natural wealth, and had a reputation for torture and authoritarianism. And so a protest against that seemed like something I would join. and at the time, a lot of people joined, not knowing that it would turn into a different authoritarian regime that was just had a different ideology. So I wanted that. I wanted that to be clear. But you know, the situation with Friend was exactly the situation you're kind of highlighting here, where the desperation of solitary confinement, where I had no way of knowing myself but through pretty much my relationships with the guards, who's the only way I could see any reflection of who I was. And I felt like I needed them so badly to just talk to. And so when really one of the two guards who spoke any English would come, I felt like I would jump up and down for him, you know?
Yeah.
And so all day he could talk to me, but he decided to talk to me during my 30 minutes of courtyard time, so which is like a nice time to kind of literally run in circles under the open sky. And he was curious, you know, he was curious about 9/11. He wanted to know what I thought of it. And what I get out of the book and in that conversation and really what our detention how I understand our detention is, it was retaliation. Our detention was retaliation. I remember on our way down from the mountain from Kurdistan, when the Iranians drove us down the mountain into their you know, country proper, we were taken to a police station, and there was a man outside the police station who was one of the people working there. And as we were being driven away, he was yelling at us and saying, do you even know what happened to the Iranians? Do you even know what America has done to the Iranians? 2 years in jail, over 2 years in jail. And I, just having been there not only a couple hours, had no idea that I would similarly be spending 2 years in jail. And this back and forth retaliation, whether I was retaliation for that or, you know, it is an endless game. At this point, the only end we can see is if these two governments come together, sign a nuclear deal, move forward with the diplomacy that's currently happening, and can marginalize these parts of both governments that are trying to keep hating the other side, keep the option of war on the table, and keep this sort of ideology of being against, either whether in Iran having America be the great Satan or America just seeing a sort of singular, simplistic, evil Iran.
I want to ask you about solitary confinement. I think it's a big theme in the book, this idea of what it does to you being confined like that, being isolated like that. Sarah, you said that being in isolation like that makes you feel like you're shrinking.
Yeah. That's one of the ways I've tried to describe it. in solitary confinement, you're slowly losing your connection to the outside world. It feels like a slow death. It's the slow motion torture of being buried alive. Want to further emphasize, you know, the context of these interactions, brief interactions we had with guards, interrogators, and other prisoners. At one point, after a few months in solitary confinement, somehow a small lizard made its way into my cell. In the first prison, there were bars over the windows, but it opened to the open air. And the presence of another living thing, this lizard, eased my anxiety so much. I hadn't felt that good for, you know, weeks or months. Studies show that in solitary confinement, your brain waves start to shift towards stupor or delirium in just 2 or 3 days. And I was in solitary confinement for 410 days. The UN says that anything more than 15 days can cause permanent lasting damage and constitute torture.
Yeah. So what, as you're thinking back on that now, more than 400 days, what effect has it had on you? I mean, do you see a kind of, it occurred to me, this idea of post-traumatic stress. I'm wondering, do you sense that at all from that experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing harder than getting out of prison is getting prison out of you. Yeah. It stays a part of you. And in prison, you have to bury all of your emotions, all of your feelings very, very deep, and then they come out at full force once you're no longer in that situation. I had violent rage, depression. I, at one point, beat a piece of furniture in my house to pieces. And I've been extremely lucky. Most people don't come out of solitary confinement and have the support that I've had. Years later, I could say I'm back to normal, or back to at least a new normal.
And something I think is important for listeners to understand is that we, in this country, have around 80,000 people in solitary confinement, more than any other country in the world. I did an investigation for Mother Jones magazine about our use of long-term solitary confinement in this country, and found people that had been in for 20, 30, 40 years in solitary confinement. Many of them had not committed violent infractions in prison, but were there because of political beliefs they held, because they were organizing, you know, against conditions. Some of them because they had, the wrong book, Machiavelli's Art of War, you know, could get somebody put in solitary.
That's a theme in the book, by the way, this idea that, and this is, it seems to have become something you all are thinking a lot about, is the irony of that fact that a superpower in the world, the United States, that they're using these kinds of techniques in their prisons. And this is something clearly you all think a lot about.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and we, you know, one thing that came up in prison a number of times was Guantanamo Bay. We had guards that, you know, when I would complain about being in solitary, they would say, well, what about the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay? And I would say, complain about being in prison. And a guard said, not going to trial for 2 years. And a guard would say, well, how long does it take for someone in Guantanamo Bay to go to trial? Right. And they really use this as justification. And, you know, I would argue with them and say, well, this doesn't justify what you're doing to us. But, it kind of gave them an excuse in a way. And I think, you know, our government was constantly calling for our release and for us to be taken to trial, and it's a hard to legitimately make that demand when, you know, there are people being held by our country that haven't gone to trial for years, some over 10 years.
We have with us Sarah Sheward, Josh Vital, and Shane Bauer. Their new book is called A Sliver of Light: 3 Americans Imprisoned in Iran. And we need to take another quick break. Back with some final thoughts when we return in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Joshua Fatale, Shane Bauer, and Sarah Shord. They're the authors of the new book, A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. So I wanted to ask you, I guess there are the parts that you keep from the experience of being in prison for that amount of time. And then there are the parts that you have to sort of get away from, that you have to abandon, I guess, get out of you. What are the parts that you have to forego? You know, I understand the good parts, I suppose, or the parts you try to make, the good that you try to get from that experience. What's the bad part that you have to rid yourself of?
You know, there becomes a very simplistic way of living in prison. You get handed a meal and pretty much I was relating to only myself and then to Shane for 22 months and just 30 minutes to sometimes about an hour with Sarah a day. But the small-mindedness, it became so hard to remember that there was a greater world, that we would get letters, and we fought hard with long hunger strikes to get some of those letters, to just remember how big and vast the world is. And the sort of shrinking shrinking of the mind felt like that's it was hard to adjust when getting out. And clearly now when I'm at home, I can feel, you know, living a free life and with my 7-month-old son, I can feel the preciousness of what's at stake and the sort of political matters, and that's something I hold on to. There's also a shedding and as you say, a letting go of a type of vigilance, a type of hypervigilance, a type of worrying if what people's motives are, you know, and in that's that kind of ambivalence that we talked about with Friend for me and for all these different guard interrogator relationships that we touched on earlier in the show, of how to sort through trust and being able to move forward in a really complex world. And I found that, you know, simple things, especially whether I had my landlord or a bureaucrat, I found myself getting really mad after leaving the post office. And I know it was just the sweetest woman behind the counter, but it got triggered by something that sounded like, you know, my interrogator was saying, right. passing the buck on to somebody else. Yeah. And I had to let all that go.
Sarah, what about you?
Well, similar to Josh, I had to let my anger go, and I had to find a way to not walk around in my own prison for the rest of my life. I think that was easier to do than for some, because I've always understood our imprisonment in a political context. I never really took it personally, as much as there's no excuse for what Iran did to us or what it does to its own people. I understand that the Iranian government is not the only government that uses people uses them as pawns and tries to take away and destroy their humanity. So I think that I feel more invested in my own country. I mean, I always have. I've always loved this country, and I love that you brought up that trip across the country with my mother when I was a really small child, because it does kind of encapsulate what it felt like to come home. And I feel responsible for what's happening in my own country and responsible for working to change what I don't think is right. And a big part of that is our own prison system. I really think we need to stop relying on punishment to rehabilitate people.
Shane, what about you?
You know, after I got out, getting out was a very confusing time for me. I, you know, imagined getting free every day while I was in prison and being this kind of joyous time. And it was, the moment of getting free was incredibly joyous, but then it got very complicated very quickly. And it was hard to adjust to making choices. I mean, I remember the first time I went to a restaurant and I couldn't choose what to eat. I asked Sarah to do it, and I asked her to do that for a little while. And I just had this tension that I carried around inside me for a very long time, and an anger that was just so deep, and I couldn't understand it because my life was so going so well. And part of how I made sense of that was connecting with other people who had been in prison. Some of them were people who were wrongfully imprisoned abroad. Some of them were, you know, regular kind of criminals that went through prison and did their time and got out. And I found a lot of similarities, you know, amongst them of what they dealt with when they got out. And it really made me appreciate what people go through, you know, when they're coming out of prison, trying to change around their lives, have a criminal past, and are dealing with these kind of feelings that I was dealing with. You know, I didn't kind of tend to deal with my frustration through violence. And for someone that does, they just have so much to overcome. I mean, we don't have a good way of kind of reacclimating people to society, especially when they're extremely isolated in the way that we were. It's, you know, we as humans adapt. We adapt to being in prison. We adapt to living in a cell. And we're also kind of slow to adapt and to readapt. So we learn, we adjust to something, and then to come out of it is tricky. To come back into freedom, it's hard to not feel like you're still in prison.
It's Shane Bauer. He and Sarah Short are married, living in Oakland these days. Josh Vital living in New York City, studying at Columbia College. Their book is called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. They joined us from the studios of NPR in New York City. And Sarah, Josh, Shane, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.